Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am swell.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, sex! Feels like it's always controversial. That's at least part of the reason why sex scenes have started disappearing from movies. But is the absence of sex also controversial? The numbers, the data, the graphs, they're fairly stark. The Economist highlighted a study from Stephen Follows in which he looked at the 250 highest grossing films every year since 2000, parsing data from the film rating bodies about sex and nudity and discovering that the percentage of those films with no sexual content increased from just under 20% in 2000 to nearly 50% in 2023. The reason for this decline of the sex scene are varied, though the biggest is certainly commercial, right? The most commercial ratings are PG and PG-13, and those movies are almost definitionally sexless. But even R-rated films aren't always comfortable with sex scenes, and when they do have sex scenes, people sometimes lose their minds. I read, with my own two eyes, complaints about the sex scenes in Oppenheimer. People said they were both unnecessary. Some people even said they were pornographic. They served no purpose for the plot or the overall meaning of the film. And I'm sorry, that's insane. They both do. They are thematically important to the story, right? They cut to the interrogation room where we see Oppenheimer sitting naked under the lights, demonstrates his feelings of humiliation and exposure at having his secrets revealed, right? The reverse shot where Kitty sees Jane Tatlock riding on top of him, staring into her eyes, it's similarly humiliating. The whole point of this sequence is to demonstrate the invasive, demeaning nature of the Inquisition that the father of the atomic bomb was subjected to for daring to speak up against the military-industrial complex's desires. What's odd is that so much of the anti-sex panic is driven by the youth, right? In stark contrast to their forebears in the baby boom and Gen X, younger millennials and Gen Z seem to be really squicked out by the notion of nudity in films. Wrapped up in all this are notions of consent, right? I cannot tell you the number of times I've seen people complain about not having consented to seeing a sex scene in an R-rated movie. They talk about it like they are the victims of some sort of sex crime here. Alongside echoes of Me Too, there is the proliferation of intimacy coordinators on sets who seem to be modern Victorians, asking directors, you know, do you really need these sex scenes for the movie? Maybe you could just do a nice dissolve between the scenes. Well, yeah, that's fine. Writing in the New York Times, Brooks Barnes suggests that movies like Challengers and Anyone But You and Bottoms show that the sex scene is making a comeback. And maybe, I don't know, I haven't seen Anyone But You, but it's worth noting that the sex scenes in Challengers and Bottoms are totally chaste. Everyone's fully clothed. The only nudity we see in Challengers, tellingly, is a shot in a men's locker room. Yes, there was a scene of full frontal nudity in the Jennifer Lawrence vehicle, No Hard Feelings, but it's shot in the dark. It's part of a comic moment. We're not talking about a bunch of movies that are like The Dreamers or Basic Instinct. Elsewhere on Substack, Freddie DeBoer argued that there's a weirdly schizophrenic response to on-screen sex amongst the younger generation, right? On the one hand, sex work in the form of OnlyFans is good and to be celebrated. It's empowering. On the other, sex scenes in movies are gross, unnecessary, intrusive, embarrassing. Here's Freddie, quote, "This is the sort of thing that many people will reflexively groan about because I'm embracing a point of view that has been communally mocked and rejected. But I believe the cliche position is correct. Many young people these days are afraid of the world generally and of sex particularly, a generalized anxiety in the face of the risk and danger that are endemic elements of human life and without which there is no pleasure and no fulfillment," end quote. Alyssa, what do you think? Are the kids correct or should I continue to yell at the clouds about them?
So sex is fun, and it can be fun to watch attractive people have sex on screen. This is my basic position. I am prepared to be pilloried for it, but it is amazing to me that this is controversial in some quarters. At the same time, I would be really curious to see actual comprehensive opinion polling about this and to understand how widespread some of these anti-sex attitudes are. Because at the same time that we see the amount of sex shrinking on screen, something that's driven certainly by sort of the rise of the PG and PG-13 movie, but also by the need to make movies exportable, including to countries that have sort of different levels of permissiveness around nudity and sex scenes. You also see the rise of a bunch of basically like porn for ladies culture, right? And arguably sort of ground zero in this is the runaway success of the, you know, 50 Shades of Grey books, then the movies. I've only watched the first movie. It's quite bad. I have actually read all three books because I'm like a total glutton for punishment. Not in the sense that movie intended. And I really should have thought that through before I said that sentence out loud. But, you know, you've got something like Bridgerton, which is one of the biggest hits on Netflix right now, that is like straight up porn for ladies, right? It's like the first season, really so. The second season, somewhat less so. But like, those are shows from Netflix that are adapted from, you know, straight up Regency romance novels, which always, part of the staple there is that like you get a bunch of extended, like, you know, not too embarrassing to read, like full on fairly explicit sex scenes, which translated to the
screens. Aren't they pretty embarrassing to read? Isn't that kind of the thing is that like all sex
shaming,
scenes.
Stop shaming the romance novel readers.
Novels are a little cringy.
Julia Quinn writes a good sex scene. What can I say? She's enjoyable to read. So at the same time that you have this sort of like cringing, supposedly millennial attitude or zennial attitude about sex, you also have a lot of fairly successful, fairly explicit content. So I have a little bit of trouble squaring all of this anecdata into sort of a comprehensive worldview and causal explanation for what's happening or not happening on screen.
Alyssa, I want to just dive into this for one second, because I had hinted at this last week when we were talking about challengers, because one of the things I have found interesting is that a lot of the times the stuff that is celebrated as steamy is very explicitly not stuff that falls into what we might categorize as the male gaze, right? So Challengers, what's the hottest scene in that movie, right? It's where Zendaya tricks the two guys into making out. The only nudity is in the locker room. Bottoms, again, is like a very, it's like a lesbian movie, but even, again, still kind of a chaste one. Or like Love Lies Bleeding, right? Which is another, like, there is explicit lesbian sex in that movie. And like, people were like, ooh, steamy, you know, and like, again, I haven't seen anyone but you, so I don't feel super comfortable commenting on it. But my sense is that there's nothing close to that explicit in it. That it is mostly just like attractive people who are clothed almost entirely throughout, you know, making out some. What we have decided is okay to celebrate and say is hot and attractive is the sort of thing that there has been a lack of, shall we say, through history.
So yes, like certainly that's true in some cases, but I feel like we're like dancing around this a little bit. Are you saying that's what's celebrated is like not like heterosexual sex where you actually see someone get penetrated?
Well, I mean, I don't know that you would necessarily need penetration. I don't know that you would necessarily need full on, you know.
Think about it this way. The movies lack an equivalent of something like the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, which does not have actual sex and doesn't have, quite pornographic, intercourse or whatever. But the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, which I think is just gone completely, was representative of a kind of vision of sexiness, right, for a long time. And it was sort of a major cultural signifier of this is what the mainstream, I'm not even saying this is actually accurate, but it was a signifier of what a kind of mainstream view of sexiness was. And you could see that view in movies, certainly in the 1980s and 1990s, like conventionally sort of Playboy, Sports Illustrated ready, you know, swimsuit, like women wearing very little, right? Like, or if not nothing, right? Who were there to be ogled by men. By
I will
straight
say,
men.
Let me put it this way. I would say that you would not see celebrated in the way that we see movies like Challengers or Love Lies Bleeding celebrated, and in the same terms, you would not see like an American Pie, right? Or a Porky's, or, you know, stuff in that genre, even like an Animal House or like I you know what I mean? Like if we want to cut to the chase, yes, I'm talking about like attractive heterosexual sex has disappeared, or not even heterosexual sex, right? Because Bridgerton is heterosexual. It's like stuff that appeals to heterosexual men, particularly.
Okay.
Is that more?
Yeah, I mean,
concrete?
I guess what I would say is that I think like part of what's interesting about this moment is that the most explicit heterosexual sex that we're seeing on film and television, outside of a certain kind of like HBO FX drama, is kind of like being aimed at like it's for like moms, right? Mm-hmm. It's yeah. You know, that's where the 50 Shades of Grey, Bridgerton comes in. But yeah, there's not like, you know, we were talking a couple of weeks ago about the remake of Roadhouse and how in the first movie there's just like an incredible amount of just like, let's get some girls naked for like no apparent plot reason, but just cause like we have these actresses, we can contractually get them to take their tops off, like let's have a naked pool party. So yeah, I think there is much less just like, here's something for the fellas. And there is also much less of the, you know, what we'd almost describe as like, what I would almost say is like the Bull Durham or Thomas Crown Affair, like adult, like sex and relationship movie that's not explicitly comic, that's, you know, meant to be kind of interesting and attractive to both halves of like a heterosexual couple going to see it on screen. I think that kind of movie has disappeared almost entirely, as has the, you know, here's ones for the lads kind of nudity. But interestingly, like that whole class of movies is like, and that kind of nudity is also in some ways sort of divorced from sex, right? Like it's a show, but it's like, here's a bunch of girls like taking their tops off to jump in the pool, or like here's a random strip scene in the bar in Roadhouse.
You go back to the 1980s R-rated male audience targeted cop movies, Beverly Hills Cop,
yeah.
48 Hours, comparable movies if they are R-rated. Beverly Hills Cop 3, not R-rated, so didn't fall into this category. Virtually all of them had something like a gratuitous strip club scene. Maybe not exactly literally the strip club scene, but something pretty close to that, where there was just like, well, we want some, this is an R-rated movie. We can put some boobs in, we'll put them in, we'll have the guys go to a strip club and they gotta, you know, rough up a bouncer and talk to the manager. And in the background, you know what? It's a strip club. So what are you going to see? That was very common. And now that's not common. But what is not very common now is online pornography, which just sort of makes access to that sort of thing much more widespread, right? You can see breasts if you want, if you have a phone, if you are an adult who does not have parental controls. Like there's nothing blocking you from seeing a photograph or a video of breasts right now. And so to some extent, that market niche, the demand there has been met in other ways, and movies don't need to do it as much.
Well, and
there are
is,
other factors available, you know, going on here.
But, yeah, yeah.
I don't mean to suggest that's the only thing.
I think the way people consume media through screens in all of its forms is a huge, huge factor here. Like you say, pornography is everywhere. Like it's not hard to find. You can get it without much effort, and that is treated, of course, very different. Like people watch movies on their phones all the time, right? People.
It's the best way to see Dune too.
People watch TV shows at the gym. They watch them on airplanes. They watch them on buses on the way to work. They watch them in line at the bank, right? And you want to keep that very separate from you know, how you consume your adult your explicitly adult entertainment, but also, and the question of consent that I was kind of joking about earlier, but that's like another issue where screens come into play, right? There's a whole pandemic of, you know, people sending unwanted naked selfies, right? Like you talking to somebody and you text them a dick pic, and nobody wants that, right?
Yeah,
and so,
but
like,
also, no one watched the unedited version of Roadhouse at the gym in 1991 because, or on the airplane, right? If you watched Roadhouse on the airplane, right, you were watching an edited for the airplanes, for the for the carriers, the air carriers version. And this is a thing that people who are like not movie nerds forget, is that in addition to TV edits that had content controls, there were also airplane edits that were slightly different because the requirements on airlines were somewhat different from the requirements for NBC, CBS, and ABC, right? So yeah. After a movie was made, a year or two later, it would debut on whatever, Sunday night on NBC. And it would also be available, in some cases, not available to an app, but it would play on some screens, on flights. And those edits were different than the edits for television, but they weren't as explicit as the R-rated theatrical cut.
One day when we have more time, I will tell you guys the story about watching HBO's Rome unedited via the airplane entertainment system that I had access to, and falling asleep and then waking up right in the middle of a scene in Rome that you might not want small children to see. All right.
That is another thing to sort of think about in this discussion, is that HBO in particular, but also Showtime and Cinemax, which everyone here has heard the term Skinemax, right? Like we're all familiar with the reputation. But HBO, I remember when I was a kid in the 90s, we didn't have HBO, but we would get the free weekends. The free weekends would be permeated with advertisements for why you should sign up for HBO, many of which explicitly advertised, there's nudity. You can see this. You can't see this even on basic cable. These shows, they have boobs in them. And that was a part of the expectation for HBO class, for pay cable shows, was just that, if you're going to, you should take advantage of the opportunity to show that stuff because you can't in a normal show. And people signed up and subscribed for that reason. And HBO, they didn't pretend that that's not what they were doing. I have drilled into my head an interview with some creator in the mid 1990s, because I would always wait for these weekends to tape movies, for me to watch later. But an interview with some creator who was you've got violence, you've got language, you've got sex and nudity, and you just can't see that, right? And they're just advertising it totally explicitly. And you can't imagine that being part of an advertising or marketing push now. Different world.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that sex is disappearing from the screen? Peter?
It's a little bit of a controversy. It's a part of the human experience. And I think that this is part of a trend in Hollywood where there is less inclination to represent the contemporary normal sort of median human experience of the people who are going to see the movies that they are selling.
Alyssa?
It's absolutely controversial. Good sex should be a good part of good entertainment. And also, guys, maybe there's more in Bridgerton for you than you thought there was.
It is definitely a controversy. It's funny, Alyssa, you started off your bit by saying, sex is fun. Watching attractive people have intimate relations can be fun. But I beyond all that, it really is again, it is part of the human experience. And if we want art to reflect that, I feel very weird that we have gotten to this point where people are like, I don't want to see that ever as part of the human experience.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked a couple times in this podcast about really liking the, 1998 remake of The Thomas Crown Affair. And that was one of the first sort of cultural representations I experienced as a teenager that was sex is fun. Sex can be kind of silly, right? That's a quite explicit movie in a lot of ways. But the characters joke around. They're silly while they're having sex. They kind of goof on each other. And it's that was one of the first cultural depictions I had of that kind of intimacy. And I think that was a valuable thing to see as a teenage girl in the 90s. And the idea of a sterile landscape free of that doesn't actually feel safer or, more useful to me than a media landscape that, maybe contained some things that were objectifying or weird, but that also was sex is the way you connect to someone else and it can feel good in more than one way. I think that's a healthy message for kids to get in, at an age-appropriate age and for adults to be reminded of. Also, it's fun. And Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo are incredibly hot.
Also, that movie was co-written by the writer of The Beekeeper, Kurt Wimmer.
And that's a controversy.
Okay. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus this Friday. We're going to be talking about the midness of so much TV. Are the highs lower and the lows higher? Have we just gotten to a nice mushy middle, you know, that is like, hey, things are pretty good. They're not always great, but they're rarely terrible. It's fine. In these post-Golden Age years, we'll talk about that on Friday. And now on to the main event. The Fall Guy. Ryan Gosling stars as stuntman Colt Seavers, who, as the film begins, is in the middle of a torrid love affair with camera operator Jody Moreno, played by Emily Blunt. And he is about to do a big stunt for the Tom Cruise-style star of the movie he's working on, a guy named Tom Ryder. He's played by Aaron Taylor Johnson. The big stunt goes bad. Colt breaks his back, and in the midst of his recovery, he disappears from the world of movies to become a valet at a family-run Mexican joint. He gets called back into the world of stunt performing when Jody, who has moved from camera operator to director of a big Dune Fury Road style action flick. That's how movies work. She wants him to fill in for the local Aussies who can't get the job done, except she didn't ask for him. Producer Gail Meyer, who's played by Hannah Waddingham, did, because Tom Ryder has gone missing. Apparently he's gotten involved with some shady characters, which might explain the body in his hotel suite. Part rom-com, part murder mystery, part big budget action spectacle. The Fall Guy is not a perfect movie. It's not a perfect movie. I have some real problems with the plotting and the underlying theme about the importance of treating stuntmen with respect that could have been solved. I think there's a very easy fix to this movie. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later because it's kind of spoilery. But it's not perfect, but it is fun. This is a genuinely fun movie, right? Gosling and Blunt are charming as hell. He's funny. She's funny. They have great timing. They're both attractive. More big budget Hollywood movies should be like this. I mean, I do have, again, my other big complaint about this movie is that David Leitch understands, he's the director of this film. He also did Bullet Train and the Deadpool movies. He understands how to shoot and stage fight. I still don't think he quite understands how to shoot and stage a big special effects spectacle, right? The big stunts here are all kind of flat, at least in terms of how they look and how they're edited. You know, not everything needs to be Michael Bay, and I know a lot of people don't like Michael Bay, but it helps when you have a guy like Michael Bay who is, like, willing to just sacrifice a multi-million dollar IMAX camera rig to get the right angle of rushing into an explosion. Everything in this movie feels like it was done at a distance or at a middle distance, even when it's shot close up and personal, as we see in the mid-credit sequence showing the behind-the-scenes stunt work that kind of unrolls like a gag reel from a mid-aughts comedy. It wasn't quite as exciting as a big movie about big stunts should be. I don't know. Peter, maybe I am going soft in my old age. I get that a lot. But I just had a delightful time watching this movie, even with all of the, like, niggling little problems with it. What say you?
Yeah, I basically agree with that. This is a very fun, very crowd-pleasing film. In fact, it's hard to recall a film that has gone out of its way to this level to try to please and cultivate an audience. We've seen a lot of big-budget blockbusters over the past couple of years, in particular the post-pandemic superhero movies that don't seem to have a reason to exist. The reason they exist is because there was a previous one before the pandemic that made enough money that they made another one, and they figured, well, you know what? It's a superhero movie. I guess people will come. And you watch these movies, and you're like, what is the reason for this movie to exist? And it's literally just the previous one hit a certain profit threshold. They have no idea what this new movie is there for or what it should be doing. This movie knows what it's there for. It knows what it wants to do. It is absolutely trying its damned hardest to connect with an audience. And I think it mostly works on that direct connection level. Gosling's performance in particular is just winning as hell. He has a kind of ineffable charm that comes along once every decade or so, and this is maybe the best movie to show it off, even more so than in Barbie, where he played Ken and kind of stole the show. I think this is probably the role that gives us the charming, silly Gosling that, like, a lot of us have wanted to see for a long time. You saw bits of this in The Nice Guys, which is maybe a better movie in certain ways, but certainly not as crowd-pleasing, as sort of a mass, it doesn't have the kind of potential mass appeal that this movie has. And so they really just found a way to get Gosling to deliver for the camera, right? Like, you can watch him do nothing in this movie and he's great. You can watch him say anything, the dumbest line of dialogue, and he's great. And in fact, I watched Bullet Train, David Leitch's previous film, which I didn't love after having watched The Fall Guy. And part of what I was thinking was, you can totally imagine Ryan Gosling in Brad Pitt's role in Bullet Train, and it's instantly a better movie, because if you, after having seen The Fall Guy and what Gosling can do with this sort of laconic, kind of like jokey lead, right? Brad Pitt's playing this assassin, you know, on the train who's like, ah, oh, I'm not so sure about this. I guess I'm going back to work, right? It's this sort of reluctant comic performance. Brad Pitt's not bad in that movie, but Ryan Gosling would have been better. And I think the Gosling-Leitch matchup is really good and really effective. I agree, Sonny, that some of the action is not... It doesn't have the, I think what you're picking up on is that it lacks tension. David Leitch is pretty good at shooting a sequence of events and making them look interesting and occasionally even awesome. But what he's not so good at is building tension into those sequences. They're light, they're fun, but because they're light and they're fun, there's never any real risk of danger, any moments where you're thinking, how the hell is this guy going to get out of this? And then having to watch him figure it out in real time, which is how action movie tension works. On the other hand, what Leitch does very well in this movie, much better than I frankly would have expected, and much better than we have seen in a very long time in a movie like this, is develop the romantic kind of tension, complications between the two leads. Emily Blunt is, I think, maybe not quite as good as Ryan Gosling in this, but great and just a delight to watch, even though she is clearly the sort of supporting secondary character to Gosling's lead. And what's really interesting about this movie is how much it leans into the romance, the rom-com aspect of it, and the way that it blends action and rom-coms. This is not something that's never been done before, but it's not something that we have seen all that much recently. And all of the action it's not designed to be big and awesome in the Michael Bay sense, and it's also not designed to be super tense and sort of taut in that, I don't know, J.J. Abrams, Mission Impossible, John McTiernan kind of sense, right? It's not designed to be tense in that way. Instead, what the action is designed to do is to reveal the state of the love affair, the romantic tension between Gosling and Blunt at all times. And so basically every action sequence is actually about that, which is a really interesting choice. I enjoyed it a lot, but clearly it didn't hit off with audiences. I'm not the first person to kind of say this is a movie with a big theme is the movies are back, which is pretty sad given that the box office here is like, oh, no, they're not back.
Yeah, but that's not the movie itself's fault. That's advertising or its audience. Like, I am always very hesitant to say like, oh, the movie failed because it didn't connect with audiences. It could
leg it up for sure.
We'll see what the second weekend hold is. No, I just one more thing before we get to Alyssa, Peter. My issue with the stunts is that they all. My issue, frankly, is that the spectacle was not there, right? I for instance, there's a big stunt where Colt drives a boat through an explosion, and it's supposed to be, it's like something he used to do for the Miami Vice stunt show, right? And it's all shot at a distance, and it all just kind of like happens out there, and it feels small. I'm sorry, that's like the only way for me to explain my issue here. It just feels small and slight, and that is kind of how I felt about all this stuff. Like, I'm glad they got the 8.5 rolls from the car, which is like a real world record. Like, that was a real world record that they broke, getting the 8 cannon rolls with the car. But they did it in the middle of a beach where there was nothing, and it just kind of looks like, okay, it's all right, crashed car on a beach.
I will defend that choice just real quick before Alyssa shows up here, because I also want to hear what Alyssa says, but I will defend the boat sequence in particular and the rest of it as David Leitch co-directed the first John Wick. And one of the things you see in the John Wick films is that those movies cut minimally and try to really show the full, the stuntmen's full bodies as they are executing stunts from the beginning of the stunt to the very end. And I think that that was part of the way that this was, that they chose to shoot this was, we want to see the whole thing with few cuts rather than sort of jumping in Michael Bay style to give us the close up and the big explosion, shooting out around the guys. Right. It's like they just wanted to see that boat run and jump in a long shot that shows it from beginning to end. So you can see the whole thing. I agree that there's
He shot it like a fight scene, and that's not what he's doing here. That's my broader point here, is that he shoots a great fight scene, but big explosion stunt sequences are not fight scenes. They are a different thing, and that would be my one note for David Leitch's. Maybe work on that a bit. All right, Alyssa, I'm sorry. What did you make of The Fall Guy?
I wanted to be charmed by this a little bit more than I was. I felt like I spent the entire movie sort of in a pleasant vibe, but there was not a moment where either I sort of laughed myself breathless or was like, oh, damn, how did they do that, right? And I think Sonny is correct that in a world where Tom Cruise is literally trying as hard as possible to kill himself in the way that will warrant like the biggest possible headline type and telling us that he's like, he's doing it all for us, man. The standards for a movie about contemporary stunts have been set quite high, especially for stunts that like an actor won't do, right? That said, I do think that this movie is very, very charming. And I think it is in part one of the things that I really liked about it, but that I wonder if might not have totally landed with audiences, is that it's not just really about how stuntmen deserve credit, but it's making fun of the entire sort of contemporary landscape of Hollywood movies, right? I mean, the biggest ongoing joke in the movie is that Metal Storm, this movie that Emily Blunt's character is directing, is obviously terrible. Like, it's just obviously terrible. The aliens look ridiculous. The plot is incredibly dumb. The, like, final speech is, you know, the sort of rallying cry speech is awful. But it's like, it's someone's passion to make this garbage, right? And it's like, it's her big break. And so, like,
and it's also very funny that it's clearly Dune meets Mad Max, which are the two big movies that sandwiched, that this thing is sandwiched between.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, like, just the fact that, you know, the contemporary blockbuster is itself terrible. I really like Hannah Waddingham. I did not actually watch the third season of Ted Lasso, but I think she's great in the first two seasons. And she's very funny here, playing a character who's essentially another kind of joke, which is that Hollywood is incredibly good at a sort of adopting the language of girl boss feminism and then using it to excuse total garbage, in this case done in the service of just like a totally feckless idiot murdering man child. And then Aaron Taylor Johnson is pretty great as this, like, you know, self-absorbed, not terribly good actor who has been like kind of propelled to the top of his industry by a woman who works incredibly hard on his behalf in ways that he will never entirely appreciate. And like, he's very good at playing a petulant man baby in this movie, like a petulant, violent man baby, right? Like, the fact that he kills someone over the, like, you know, the insult that he doesn't do his own stunts when everybody knows his own stunts. Like, just all of the, you know, his terrible apartment, like the music that comes on when Colt walks into the various rooms. Like, this is an incredibly funny movie to watch if you pay as much attention to movies as we do, because it is it's so layered full of jokes about the absurdity of contemporary Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, the star is named Tom, and the producer is named Gail, right? And who is the most, like, maybe the most influential female action producer ever? Gail Ann Hurd, who was James Cameron's wife for a while, and then even after they split up during the production of The Abyss, went on to become, like, an incredibly influential action movie producer. Right. Like, you know, this movie has total plausible deniability about the guy named Tom who maybe doesn't do his own stunts, who runs weird, but also.
the Tom Ryder, Tom Cruise, you know, I do all my own stunts thing is interesting. But I do think the movie pulls its punches slightly because there's a much cleaner version of that plot line where it was spoilers, because I have an issue with how everything in this movie plays out, because none of the actual murder mystery stuff makes much sense. But there's a version of the story where it is very explicitly, like, it is more focused, more centered on Tom Ryder tries to kill Colt Seavers for, you know, making a joke in front of the crew or something about him not doing his own stunts. Then he actually kills this other stunt guy. And then, like, you just tie it. They could have tied it all together at the end by putting Colt Seavers in a position where he makes Tom do his own stunt and he kills himself. And, like, that wraps a nice little bow around the whole thing. And it felt like they wanted to pull back from that just slightly. Like, all right, we're not going to make a movie about how all of these asshole actors deserve to die in the service of the stunts, but then they still kill him anyway. He still wanders off into the like minefield and blows himself up. The whole thing is just confused. And I think Peter, you mentioned the way the stunts kind of echo the love story. I do think the movie got lost in the love story just a little bit. I feel like I think there's a version of this film that's better, that is focused entirely on the murderous psychopath movie star with the love angle, you know, kind of tossed in, instead of like him trying to get her back or her trying to get him back, and also a murder. Like, it is less compelling than it could have been, I think.
Yeah.
I think the movie acknowledges that it has third act problems repeatedly. In the text of the movie.
It's such a cheat, too. And that also annoyed me, frankly. That was like, I was like, you can't just say the movie has third act problems and then have third act problems.
Interestingly, though, I mean, I do agree that it kind of pulls its punches on, you know, the Tom Ryder character. But where it's actually pretty tough is, I don't know how much you guys know about the relationship between Tom Cruise and his agent Paul Wagner and the sort of symbiosis of that partnership, which I think at some point fell apart.
Yeah.
But I mean, that relationship has been a kind of interesting artistic inspiration on and off. There's a novel called The Actress that's very much about, I mean, it's very clearly about Wagner and Cruise, and is sort of rooted in speculation, sort of the Tom Cruise characters gay in the books. But it's very much about the sort of kind of poisonous nature of both living your entire life to create someone else and then of being someone else's creation. And, you know, in sort of making fun of that relationship, that like that feels a little bit audacious to me in a way that, I think like most people who watch the movie won't get at all, that like it's about a, you know, particular, like, very speculated upon professional dynamic in Hollywood. But to the extent that it's a movie sort of making fun of Tom Cruise at all, the fact that it is this much rooted in the Cruise-Wagner relationship is kind of interestingly tart to me.
Yeah, Paula Wagner was the name that came to mind when I was watching it, not Gail Ann Hurd, despite Gail Ann Hurd being name-checked more, yeah, kind of. Pseudo
it seemed to me like the movie was doing both, but maybe wanted to not go after Paula as explicitly.
Yeah, given, there's a little bit of plausible deniability there.
I mean, I wouldn't want to mess with her.
Frankly, I would love to get Tom Cruise to sit down and just give his notes on the script of this movie, just like from a pure story, because he would identify everything that's wrong with it in about in 30 seconds flat, because that man has a brain for movies. It's whatever else you want to say about him. He's got a brain for movies. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Fall Guy? Peter.
It's a good movie. Thumbs up.
Alyssa.
Thumbs up. I watched it on a day when I had a lot of other things on my mind and I want to see it again.
Thumbs up. I would say it's an entertaining movie. I'm not 100% sure it's a good movie, but it's an entertaining movie and I found it very charming.
I'm going to give it a thumbs up still, but I want to say it's a good time at the movies.
It's a good time at the movies.
Even
it's
if it's
time.
Not necessarily
there's,
a good
There's something to be
movie.
Said for being a for having a good time at the movies. I'm
very
pro having
time.
A good time at the movies. And this was a good time. I enjoyed myself. Yeah, it has seven endings, sure. It doesn't know how to stop. It just keeps going. It keeps going and going, and there's post-credit scenes and mid-credit scenes. And
so did Return of the King.
eventually it just kind of ends. But, you know, we'll see what happens in The Fall Guy 2 that's never going to get made. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our audio engineer, Jonathan Siri, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.